Okay. No worries.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
Well, hello, everybody. I'm here all by myself without Nate G. This is Dr. Doug Lyle, and I'm here without Dr. Jen Hawk. So it's just me. Nathan's having trouble getting logged in, and Jen has taken the night off. So not only are we minus our Dr. Jen, but we're also minus Nate. So I am now doing both jobs, which is incredibly difficult, and therefore you'll just have to make do with how I do it. All right. What we're going to be doing this evening is I'm going to be going down through some questions that Nate emailed to me. And so he could pop on at any time and take over that job. But until then, we're going to get started. The first question that came in was about why do people seek revenge and compensation pain from a person who has angered them, even if they lose as well? So why do people take an approach of I will hurt you back even if it means I get hurt as well when they're in a rage? The what people are trying to do there is, as best as I can tell, is they're attempting to alter the future of disagreements. So originally what's happening is that they feel like they're being aggressed against quite unfairly, and they're not able to, through normal negotiations and normal level of threats, actually assure themselves that they're going to be able to get change in the other party. So what they have to do is that they have to exact pretty severe damage to the other team to let the other team know that if you may be able to dominate the situation, you may be able to defeat me. However, it will be extremely costly for you to do so. And so this kind of sort of we're going to call this a protean price, protean meaning unpredictable price. So by being so enraged and unstable in exacting a revenge, the advantage is the person on the other side, who could be having the upper hand in the situation, doesn't know what it's going to cost them in order to continue to press this advantage and continue the exploitation. So I would see graphic evidence of this in my time working in the prison, where some small skinny guy about my size would be being exploited by some a big monster who would be taking their lunch and or something of the nature. And so whatever the conflict was, but so what would happen was that, you know, a lot of these guys, not everybody that's in the prison is this way, certainly, but there's a higher percentage of people in prison that have the capacity for pretty significant violence, sort of a lower threshold when that gets released. And that includes some of these people that are not very big and not very imposing. And so as a result, they could go off, or they could certainly threaten that they were going to go off, and they might. And so in doing so, the notion is, yeah, you may take five of my teeth with you, but I'm going to get a big bite out of your ear. And you'll never see that ear again, okay? And so the notion is that you may harm me very significantly, but you will pay a price to do so. So this and so the the individual that is in the upper hand has to think twice about going after somebody who's a little crazy and or is that enraged. So this is the way that we can balance the scale against exploitation. So that's the fundamental reason I think that we see this as an adaptive system, because it's what we might call protean price, unpredictable price. By advertising that you don't know what the price is going to, you know, the other person cannot anticipate fully what the price is, it makes it inherently more expensive to provoke the person who's in a submissive position. All right.
Dr. Lyle, I think I'm back. Can you hear me?
Ah, that's fantastic. Okay. All right.
Sorry about that.
No worries. Good to hear your voice. Glad to have you here. Otherwise, I'm going to get tired of just listening to myself.
Well, it's been 194 episodes. We aren't tired yet.
Yes. All right.
All right. So I heard you go over that first question about the evolutionary psychology of punishment and how this is essentially preventing people from aggressing you further in future conflicts.
Right.
And so some of the article we were going to go over is about it's called Punishment Isn't About the Common Good, It's About Spite. And it's Patrick Forber, associate professor at Tufts University, and Rory Smead, professor of philosophy at the Ronald and Linda Rossetti Professor of Humanities in North and East University in Boston. So they basically, there was an article published, but essentially they're talking about punishments when people get caught doing something. And so it made me think of the prison system. So people say, oh, you got to, you know, we'll put you in prison and let you think about it. But from, it sounds, you know, just from our episode long time ago about, the inside the criminal mind, it seems like, you know, what are your thoughts on punishing somebody for something like this?
Well, punishment is a useful mechanism, and the threat of punishment is a useful mechanism because, the sort of, we have to understand that criminal minds are not deranged or different than anybody else's mind. They're the same minds. It's the same gene pool. It's the same same cost-benefit analytic mechanisms inside the machine. And so these folks that do criminal acts, don't think of them as criminals per se. Think of them as people who choose to do things that at the moment they think are in their best interest, but they are running the risk of penalties. And so, of course, they are not irrational beings. They may be beings that don't do a very good job of computing their long-term best interest, but that's different than thinking of them as irrational. And so they are undoubtedly responding to their perceived probability of success and failure with respect to whatever it is that they're doing. So you need to have a system in a civil society where there is a price to be paid for transgressing the rules. And you want those prices to be essentially logically related to what makes sense to people so that they can rationally compute them. It doesn't do any good to have very severe penalties if the 84 IQ criminal that's about to do that criminal act doesn't know that that's what the penalty is. Okay. So this is why, you know, it behooves us to have, they ought to actually have a class in high school on crime and punishment so that you actually know what the prices are. Might not, that people find out on the streets, in those neighborhoods where those behaviors are common, people get some sense of, what the justice system is likely to throw you as the price. Everybody knows if you shoot somebody to death, you are in serious trouble. Whereas if you rob them at gunpoint, that's a different kind of trouble. And if you sneak into their house and steal their watch, that's yet a different kind of trouble. So crime and punishment is simply a part of a wider context of us essentially rewarding and punishing or penalizing behaviors that other people do with respect to us in order to optimize our own personal situation in a social context. So social relationships have both prices and benefits, and the benefits overwhelmingly outweigh the costs. The costs are that when we live in close proximity to a lot of people who have lower conscientiousness, lower intelligence, higher impulsivity, and more disagreeability than we have, there will be criminal behavior that will take place. So our job is to recognize that these differences, not only do they exist, but they're stable, they're predictable, and you know, keep yourself out of harm's way as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. A second article that we were going to go over is called Group Punishment Doesn't Fix Behavior, It Just Makes Kids Hate School. And Now, you know, we're talking about individual punishment, but now if we talk about group punishment, I guess probably the one that comes to mind most is such that, like in the military, where they punish an entire group for the actions of one. So what are your thoughts on group punishment in that sense?
We're probably going to find that in general, it's not very effective just because the individual themselves who is running the CB on that isn't probably overly concerned with their compatriots. The individual that's going to break ranks and do something that's self-serving but costly to the group probably isn't, in other words, it's going to work fine for everybody that's high conscientiousness who wouldn't do the thing anyway. So I think that we're going to find that style of punishment is not going to be very effective just because, you know, obviously we could change the context where it would be. So if it's like, well, if we've got five of you in the room and we say that everybody better do it right, and if the five of you are related, these are people super important to you. So suddenly everybody's on the same page more than they would otherwise be. So we can see that, for example, in the famous Milgram studies that were so amazing that people would ostensibly shock people to death. And so, you know, folks went inferring that, oh, my God, this is what people will do if they're told by authorities to do this. Well, not if it's your mother, they won't. So when we start changing the specific cost benefit, instead, we go from a general principle to a more refined principle of genetic cost-benefit analysis that's actually running the machine, we can start to get more precise in our understanding of what's happening. So if I've got, you know, 40 people that I don't really know, and I've got that I don't really care that much about, and there's some rule that we will all have to do 100 push-ups if I get caught dogging it on my push-ups, but I can't do these push-ups very well, and I might not even be able to do them. So I'm going to start very cleverly skipping them, okay, as best I can. So I'm running the CB on that. And the fact that that I may cost my compatriots a bunch of work really is not my chief concern. My chief concern is myself. Okay. So once again, the solution to any of these mysteries is to strip away any concept really of group action and think in terms of individual life units, analyzing their own personal genetic cost-benefit analysis that certainly will encompass their analysis of the value of their group membership and the loss of esteem processes that could take place with respect to transgressions. However, the group is not everything. What's everything is their own personal genetic interests. And once we understand that, these mysteries of human nature strip away pretty easily.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So the mystery of human nature in the sense of punishment in this sense also is one of the questions that we got is, are there any evolutionary reasons for harming oneself or cutting and sending signals to others by harming yourself?
Oh, yeah. So this is the cutting that takes place is very often we'll get diagnosed with quote borderline personality disorder, whatever that is. And, and so what we're really talking about is this is going to be what we call costly signaling. So these individuals that do this, and I've met many of them, they're not crazy. They're not anything remarkable about them, other than they're usually very competitive, often very highly conscientious, driven individuals who are really frustrated about something. And as a result, costly signaling, by cutting, there's these theories that, they feel a lot better, they get an endorphin rush or whatever. And I don't know what transpires in the mind and nervous system of these folks specifically. But the question is, why would there be an evolutionary profit from self-harm? Well, we can see more than one interest, more than one angle by which there's evolutionary profit from self-harm. So the ego trap is clearly an example where you harm your ability to optimize your potential by handicapping yourself or bluffing that you are not wanting to try in order to protect your status. So you can see how self-harm could absolutely be a function its way through any kind of motivational equation that would make perfect Hamiltonian logic. And in the same way would be true with cutting. So cutting winds up being essentially, instead of tapping somebody on the shoulder and say, hey, I'm really in trouble and I'm really frustrated, that's one signal that you could make. But a more costly signal is to actually start to do very dangerous looking quasi-suicidal damage. Now it is not so easily dismissed. Okay, so now we don't, you can imagine, imagine two parents with a 15-year-old daughter, and the daughter complains about, her frustration, her anxiety, her depression, and her feeling overwhelmed. Okay, so we got two concerned parents. They talk to her, they tell her to, relax, don't worry about it, it's okay, do the best you can, etc. They do this, and yet her frustration is really acute. So the kid's in trouble. And so the next level of, or an additional gear that she could hit would be to start cutting her wrists. Okay. At that point, this is a discernible, there's evidence of self-mutilation here. So now the anxiety goes up in those parents considerably. Now they mobilize more resources as they try to figure out, how can I reduce the burdens or stress on my kid? Okay. So once again, costly signaling is telling people that we mean business. And that's just as we were talking about in the earlier issue, the little pipsqueak on the prison yard who gets into it with a big guy, is getting exploited, and then just goes off and completely, he bites a guy's ears off and swallows it just like little Arliss does in Old Yeller. Okay. So he actually does it. Okay. He gets pounded and he's in the infirmary for 4 months recovering. But when he comes back on the prison yard, what do we see? Okay. We see like, whoa, look out. Yeah. You may pound him, but you don't have an ear. Okay. So everybody gives this guy wider berth, i.e. costly signaling. So the same concept, our interactions with all people are being run through their cost-benefit analysis as we bring both threat and opportunity in every interaction that we have with them. So they're having to run what their assessment is of us, our personality, and our analysis of the situation, the circumstantial particulars, as we clearly are running a CB on them and their interactions with us. And so what we signal makes a big difference in what it is that they do. And that's how all of these sort of any of these mysteries can be unwound, by looking at it through that lens.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the prison yard, and it reminded me of an email a listener sent us a long time ago saying, what would your advice be to somebody who goes into prison? Like, what would Dr. Lyle do if he was in a prison yard? Would he just beat up the biggest guy there first? So maybe we know a little closer to the answer.
No, I think that the right answer would be you signal that you have something that's really valuable. So this is how the guy in Shawshank Redemption, in other words, he starts doing everybody's taxes. So you start to figure out how it is, like Alan Goldhammer and I actually talked this over, and Alan said that he would immediately go up to the toughest guy and start to explain to the guy how he could improve his monetary situation. And so he would get in with that, and that's how he would do it. And Alan being Alan, you know, Alan was selling cinnamon toothpicks on the bus back and forth from school when he was 6 years old. So yeah, he knows a little bit about how to make a buck.
Selling the pleasure trap at a young age.
That's right. You got it.
And how about you, Dr. Lyle?
No, never made a nickel. Never happened.
No, I mean, what would you do?
God, I'd probably get in with a bunch of basketball players, and I would see to it that they knew that I was going to give them a lot more shots as a result, and I'd become known as the very unselfish ball player, and therefore worth protecting. And that's what I would do. Yeah.
All right. I love it. All right. So our next question is actually a little more lighthearted. This is about the fairness of male-female dynamics. Dear Dr. Lyle, it's kind of a weird question, but why is it so hard to convey to guys and male partners that they should simply put down the toilet seat after they are done peeing? I've had this discussion with my significant other and my brother as well, and they both tell me that it's the same effort for me to put the seat down, even in my own apartment, although they have to put it up first when I was on the toilet before, since it is obviously down, so they would have to do an extra step. I find this conversation extremely unnecessary and childish. However, it seems to me that there's something deeper behind this. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to me to make such a big fuss about it. I know it sounds dumb, but I'd like to hear your take on it.
Oh, I think this is really interesting. So let's look at this, because once again, we're just going to look through the lens of evolutionary biology to look to the heart of what's driving all behavior. And what's driving all behavior is simply efficiency at translating muscular action into DNA. So why do they not put the toilet seat down? Because it would take effort. Why is she bitching about it? Because when she comes in, the toilet seat is up and she's going to have to put it down. Okay. So she leaves and the toilet seat's down. Does she then put it up because they're statistically more likely to be the next one in the bathroom? No. She leaves it down from her standpoint, it's in its proper place. From their standpoint, it's in its proper place when it's up. So I don't really see how she has any room to complain here. It's essentially two different entities with two different idealized positions for the toilet seat. And they're complaining about, you know, that there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. So we could get further that, I guess, when they poop, they would want it down. So maybe in principle the best, but the truth is a guy will urinate 7 times a day on average, and they're going to poop maybe once. So 6 out of 7 times, they're going to want it up. So it's basically they want it up. So it's just energy conservation and complaining that the other party isn't doing what we want. that's the end of that mystery.
Uh-huh. Yeah, someday there'll be a button right next to the light switch that puts it up or down depending on what you want. So
yeah, well, it'll scan which gender you are, okay? And it will raise or lower the seat, okay? That's how that works.
Well, the way things are
but
going,
then,
there might be
what do you do in the modern environment? You have his, hers, and then things in the middle. What do you do then?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh, my light switches, marvelous colleague, Jen Hawk, is now cringing. She's just cringing that I said that. All right, let's move on.
Well, thank you for that mystery, because growing up in a household with two sisters and a mother, it was a fun discussion. I mean, I never had a problem doing it, but it was always like, you know.
Yes.
All right.
Good kid.
All right.
Yeah, let's go on.
Dear Dr. Lyle, what is it about human social psychology that makes Stone Age tribes or villages tend to max out at around 50 or 150 people or so? Mm-hmm. Was it that nothing could invite more people than that under any common purpose?
That's not sort of, but not quite. The common purpose, the only common purpose that makes any sense is a common purpose that the purpose of the entire organism is to reproduce DNA. So therefore, the common purpose would be what's in, if I'm doing something that's in my interest, is also in your genetic interest and vice versa. So that would lead to the cohesiveness that would lead to tribes. Now, apparently, I don't have great evidence for this, although I've read it in multiple sources, but I never, somebody somewhere that I read some, 15 years ago, talked about how some mathematician, I think, built a model about what we're gonna talk about is these Sewell-Wright coefficients, or I would call them Hamiltonian. So these are coefficients of genetic relationship, and so you can see that that if you're in a family and everybody's 50% genetically related except mom and dad, who aren't related to each other, but they have a bunch of children of which half of their genes each are in each of those children. So they have extraordinary common interests, and you're going to find out that this is going to be a situation that will minimize the conflicts of interest between the individuals. Now, you might say that you had a lot of conflicts with your siblings over resources, but the truth is those conflicts would be far less as a result of the coefficient of genetic relationship than they would be under situations where you were not related to those people. Think of yourself stuck in a boat you're lost on a boat in the middle of the Pacific, and it turns out that the one other person that dumped into that boat off the big ship is not related to you. So now you've got, two candy bars in your pocket. So you can imagine that, you might be extremely interested in hiding those candy bars from them, waiting till they're asleep and then consuming them both. Because the truth is that you might compute that maybe that's my best move to increase my likelihood of survival. Whereas if it's your brother, you're very likely to give him one of the candy bars. That's because genetically, his survival is very important to you, genetically. So people might roll their eyes, but this is exactly how inheritance law goes down. And this is how, so many decisions get made, not only for humans, but throughout the animal kingdom. So you see mama lions sacrificing their own health in order to defend their cubs, and they'll also defend their nieces and nephews, but they won't defend the next degree relative over. They won't defend a third degree relative over, i.e. a cousin. So these coefficients of genetic relationship are super powerful in attempting to understand the way that an organism evaluates the well-being of another organism and what they're going to do with respect to self-sacrificial behavior. Now, you can imagine that if there's conflict of interest between two people, the system would essentially say, I think, when it's 50-50, two people both feel like the other person may be exploiting them to some degree. This is what I call, the 10% bias. So the average person feels like they're getting chiseled a little bit at work, and the average employer feels like they're getting chiseled a little bit by the employees. So, when you buy a car, you feel like you're getting chiseled a little bit by the dealer, et cetera. So there's just a concept that the set point in the nervous system for a human being is going to be suspicious that it's being chiseled a little bit. That's an adaptive distortion inside the system. This is what I call a Darwinian distortion. So this is similar to inferring that when a twig snaps in the woods that it's a predator. That's a Darwinian distortion. It's similarly a distortion to feel like in a 50-50 deal that I got a feeling that I'm being chiseled a little bit. Okay. Now, that being the case, you can see that the feeling, the adaptive mechanism of feeling like I'm being chiseled a little bit, is going to be significantly dampened down if the person on the other side of this is my brother. Because even if I get chiseled in the transaction and he winds up benefiting 7% extra in our transaction, the truth is that half of my genes are located in him. So he's actually only making off with 3.5 for himself, and 3.5 I'm getting paid back indirectly because my genes are located inside of him. So as a result, the first degree or the degree of genetic relationship that sits commonly within a small group, for example, is going to be an extraordinary buffer in reducing the acrimony that's going to go on when there's going to be transactions where individuals feel like they're being chiseled. This is going to aid and abet group cohesion, because the reason they are there is that there are advantages to being in groups, because there's insurance policies that get generated as a result of group action that you cannot insure yourself as a single individual. So there's a cohesiveness that naturally emerged in humans, that there was an advantage to being close together. Richard Wrangham believes that it fundamentally began with the protection of food, and he's probably right. It makes a lot of sense that that would be true. It's a fascinating work that he wrote called Catching Fire, really quite a great story about the evolution of human cohesiveness around fire, food, and then also really spelling out the details of romance, about how romance evolved in humans along with the tribal mentality and essentially the same tribal structures that you see today, you know, in hunter-gatherer societies around the world. Now from there, we go to the interesting observation that it would appear that these tribes don't typically get bigger than about 150. So now they tend to split off and go into then smaller groups. Now what the thought is that the willingness to be at peace with transactions where somebody is exploiting somebody at 10% in the transaction, but if we're first degree relatives, half of that winds up being reciprocated back to me anyway through the genes, and so therefore I'm not into, you know, it's not a bad transaction, and I'm willing to get screwed over in a transaction by a few percent, because the overall benefit of the trade is actually valuable. Remember, I'm not trading at all I'm not trading oranges for orange. I'm trading essentially some kind of division of labor and division of luck, mine versus theirs, and the trading process creates a consumer surplus on both sides of the trade. So therefore, even if I'm being chiseled in the trade, I'm probably still ahead, or I wouldn't do it. And then if it's my brother, there's an additional kicker in it that my genes are benefiting. Now, as you start to move our way out to 150 people, what's going to happen is that the average coefficient of genetic relatedness in the entire group of 150 starts to drop to very low levels, to the point where the Hamiltonian advantage of the kickback from trades starts to be negligible. So now it's going to turn out that we're no better off there than we are if we just had a whole slew of people that we were not related to. So what happens is this would drive people then, probably, if anybody studied it, it's a great doctoral dissertation, or quite frankly, it's an entire career for some Evo cultural anthropologist that, you know, was sensitive and understood selfish gene theory, that probably what you're going to find is that when people break apart out of that group of 150, they take with them 25 or 30 people who are a tighter gene pool, who have a coefficient of genetic relationship that is very substantial. So now we begin again an insurance pool that has that kicker in place. So that's almost certainly what is happening, that's what did happen. Now the question is, how do you get to the modern environment where you're able to have these huge coalitions, et cetera? And the answer is that with the dawn of agriculture, you massively intensified human populations. So you made it far more possible to support 100 times more people on a given unit of land. And it was also more efficient. In other words, there was more calories per unit of effort expended. So what's going to happen behind that is that you're starting to get division of labor as a result of the increased efficiencies of agriculture, as well as you get people starting to get up some pretty sophisticated learning curves, and you have a lot of teaching that's going to be able to go on as a result of a lot of people in close proximity. With the specialization of labor, the myelin sheath and other knowledge is going to start to get specialized in individual brains. And the trading process is now wind up being super worth it. Okay. So even if you're getting exploited in a trade, remember, if you're in a simple village with very few people, there isn't that much specialization of ability. And so for the trading process, you're trading often for things that you could literally do yourself, but you're not quite as good at it, or that wasn't your day, or you weren't that lucky. And so, whereas when you start to get an agricultural society that has 500 or 1,000 people, and only half of them are involved in the land, and the other half are specialized in getting very effective at doing other things very, very efficiently, now they're so good at what it is that they do that you couldn't just do it yourself. So the advantages of trade become quite spectacular. And the fact that you may often feel out negotiated in the trade, you feel like they've got a better deal than you have, you choke it down more often because it's still in your best interest. And so probably the vast consumer surpluses that were involved, that were derived from trade processes under large populations under agriculture, made it possible for human beings to build vastly larger aggregates of humans peacefully. Something that could not happen in Stone Age societies where the consumer surplus and exchanges were far less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember watching a video from Milton Friedman who said he shows a pencil and he said, there's no way that someone could have made this pencil on their own by mining the rubber for the eraser and getting the rubber trees and all. I mean, it's fascinating what we can do collectively.
Yes, absolutely. That's a famous essay. I forget who wrote it, but it's called I, Pencil, and people can Google it. I think it was all the way back written in the 1950s. It was a spectacular demonstration of the collective genius of human beings as a result of trade, something that was explained the best I ever saw it was in The Rational Optimist by Ridley, as he takes us from paragraph one, page one of that book shows a hand axe and a mouse, a computer mouse, and explains how did we get from a hand axe 10,000 years ago to a computer mouse today. And what caused that was, a whole series of changes driven by agriculture that lead to large populations, huge divisions of labor, until the average individual is now sitting in the middle of trades where they are trading with the collective genius of the earth. And their trades are incredibly efficient as a result of that. So as much as people sometimes feel like they want to, quote, get back to the land, when they go back to the land, they're going to find out that they're working awfully hard for almost nothing. And it winds up, there may be satisfactions from doing that, but it's going to turn out that that's a very, very hard way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Dr. Lai, we've got a caller who's been on hold for the show. I think we have time to take a caller. So.
Sure. Let's take a caller and see what happens.
All right. Caller, welcome to the show. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Brian from Jacksonville.
Yes.
Hey, Brian.
All right,
welcome.
Brian.
All right. Well, I'm gonna ask a pretty controversial question from a show you guys did earlier. I heard you guys talking about two parents that are smart and heard about something about the offspring of those parents facing return to the mean in intelligence. Now, I know what that term means as far as economics, where if one company is having excess profits, that will attract competitors, which will drive the profits down to basically the marginal cost. That makes sense to me. Or the same thing with arbitrage in finance. But genetics and evolution, I thought that if there was a trait that was advantageous, the parents would be more likely to pass it off to their offspring, and that's how evolution works. And I've heard certain pundits say that, and this is the controversial part, that different races have different average IQs. So even if we bring in, say, there's a really smart guy from India, and he comes into the West, if he has kids, his kids won't necessarily be super smart. The intelligence of his children would return to the average of that population from that country or that race or whatever. So I was just wondering what your thoughts were basically about that and how that works, return to the mean with intelligence, and how it works with evolution.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And recent evidence has come to light to make this much more PC than we might have thought. I can remember I read an article, Brian, just a couple years ago. It was Jeffrey Miller. And Miller was, you know, people that have listened to me know that I have great admiration for Jeffrey Miller's intelligence. I don't necessarily have great admiration for his personality. He is who he is. He's his own man, and he makes his own mistakes, and that's fine by me. But I have legitimate admiration for a searing intellect that he carries. And so when he wrote a piece, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, maybe somebody could find it, where he was basically saying that the Chinese government, by virtue of their, you know, draconian control over the population, was busy looking for these genetic indicators of high IQ. And he had said that they had found such an indicator. In other words, they'd found a specific gene that was associated with super high IQs. And so he said, listen, it's game over for the West, that the West will no longer be dominant in world history, because the Chinese government is going to go about its business of essentially selectively breeding individuals that carry this gene. And essentially what they're going to do is that in a single generation, they can massively increase the average IQ, and in 2 or 3 generations, they can spectacularly increase the average IQ as a result of this. And so he's basically saying, listen, you're going to have an entire population of 1 billion people with 3 generations. So they're going to be walking around with what would be a 99th percentile IQ relative to the West, at which point you could forget it. They'll outcompete you in every single aspect of commercial and military problems that there is. And I read that and I thought, oh my God, I can't believe what I'm looking at. I'm not going to have to worry about it because I won't be here, but I could literally see the possibility that such a thing could be true, that there could be people in the leadership of China that would be thinking along those lines, and there would be nothing to stop them in a society like that from actually executing on it, whereas, of course, nobody in the West would ever even think of doing such a thing, and there won't be such a thing that will ever take place. And so I thought, oh my God, that's literally possible. And it's not only at the end of that article, it was not only possible. I mean, as fantastical as it is as a concept, I mean, there's a tremendous logic to it. And I thought, wow, I wonder, it's not like it happens overnight. It just gently starts happening. The mean IQ of China goes from, 107 to 108 to 109 to 115 to 121 to 126 to 135, and then it's just like unbelievable. The productivity of IQ juxtaposed to high technology, makes a very smart person, super potentially valuable, as witness the salaries in Silicon Valley. Okay, so now I looked at that. And I kind of put it away in the corner of my mind and shrugged my shoulders and said, well, there's nothing I can do about it. And I don't really care that much, but it's weird. And then I read Plowman. And Plowman explained something that Jeffrey Miller didn't know when he was writing that article, even very recently, which is that even though there may be a marker gene that is associated with these very high IQs, that gene isn't responsible for it. Therefore, if you select on it, it isn't going to do any good. And so the truth is that there isn't one gene or 5 genes or 13 genes or 27 genes. And if there's 5 genes, you're sunk anyway. Okay. But but it's not. IQ differences, differences in physical appearance, differences in propensity to gain weight, athleticism, beauty, anything that you look at, it turns out thousands of genes are involved. So every gene has a tiny little influence. Essentially, the genes are like little tiny grains of sand, and together they collectively build a sculpture. But no one gene is responsible, and no 50 genes are responsible. So this is a very heartening and pleasant discovery that is not controversial and has now settled the issue. So it was no surprise then. We wouldn't have known the parameters of this issue until we had done the scientific research. But behind this understanding that Plowman says was way off the radar 20 years ago. Like nobody had any idea that what I'm saying is true. Well, a few people had an inkling that it might be true, but nobody really thought that this was true. Everybody thought that, you know, the differences in people's weights might be due to 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 genes. The differences in IQ might be as a result of 10 genes. That made sense. The differences in whether people are depressed or not depressed might be a certain amount of genes. They were looking like crazy for the gene or genes that might be responsible for schizophrenia. Okay, so they knew it wasn't one gene because it didn't fall along Mendelian genetic probabilities. But it turns out that, I mean, they were thinking, oh, I don't know, maybe 5, maybe 10, maybe it's on chromosome 17, like whatever, all kinds of ideas. Everybody was wrong. It turns out it's thousands and thousands of genes. And so as a result, it turns out to be the case that offspring's IQs are expected to be 13 points different than the parents' IQs. And if two regular unrelated people in the population drawn randomly from a crowd in Times Square on New Year's, the average difference between those two people is only 17 points. So the of course, very intelligent parents are likely to have intelligent children, but they're also likely to have children that are average. And so it's not going to be the case that the Chinese or anybody else is going to be able to selectively breed a pair of 150 IQ parents and wind up with a 150 IQ child. If they breed a couple of parents that have 150 IQs, the child is very likely to have 137 IQ. Okay, and then if they breed that child, the second generation, to 150 IQ superstar, then the mean of those two people would be 144. So therefore, the next child out is likely to be 131. Okay, so they aren't able to maintain it. As we see, the high IQ parents who started out at 150, their child will be 137. Their grandchild will be 131. It's not going to fly. Okay, so this is the regression to the mean phenomenon. And that's, you know, that's why there's a young man out there who loves basketball, and his name is Michael Jordan. He's Michael Jordan's son, and he's a pretty big guy. I think he's 6'2", 6'3", played college basketball at some tiny little podunk school. He wasn't very good. He got heckled because he wasn't anything like his dad, but he loved the game and he played anyway. So he's basically a small-time, little, you know, small college hack basketball player. Good for him. I'm glad and I'm proud of the guy that he went out there and played because he loved the game, even though he can't even sniff the big time even in college ball. So that's regression to the mean, and so that's how it actually works. When it comes to races, there are racial differences in personality. There's racial differences in physical abilities of various kinds on average. Okay, within every what you would call a race, there's a huge diversity of individuals in there. But within each of those, that you could plot a bell curve, and those bell curves are going to be different on every possible dimension, including the structure of their teeth. Okay. So I have a good friend of mine that went into a dentist, finally got there, and the dentist looked at her teeth and said, are you part Asian? And she said, no, not to my knowledge. She goes, oh, are you part Indian? She said, yeah, in fact, I am. So it turns out there's some characteristic that is discernible in tooth structure that, you know, eight generations ago, her, you know, somebody mated with a Native American, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago. So, but that characteristic's typically seen in Asia. So anyway, in answer to your question, are there differences? Sure. But that's not, I'm not particularly interested in those differences for any particular reason. The, we don't, groups don't get jobs, groups don't achieve, individuals do. So what we're really interested in here is the impact of genes on individuals and our personal individual offspring and what this means, and how evolution would work here. And what we find is that that two very smart people are likely to have an above average child. They may have a really smart man. They may have an average one. So I know of two people whose IQs I can definitely tell you are north of 140. I know both of them, and their child is literally in the middle of the bell curve. Okay, so this is regression to the mean, and whatever we said that you heard last time is true. And anybody that thinks like begets like in very tight tolerances, and therefore there's a stratification of genes and capability that was essentially predicted by the bell curve in 1986, this turns out to be not true. That the genes and their attendant strengths and weaknesses flow reasonably freely up and down the gene pool, and that's actually how inheritance seems to work in our species. Okay.
Okay. That's,
all right.
That makes a lot of sense.
All right.
Yeah,
Brian,
go ahead, Brian. I'll give
you
a follow up. Yeah, we'll give him a follow up. Go ahead.
Yep. Go ahead, Brian.
Oh yeah. Is there a book that you would recommend if I want to learn a little bit more about that, and also a book you would recommend if I want to learn a little bit more about personality psychology, the Big Five?
Yeah, it's actually. The two books that I would recommend if you want to understand behavior genetics is Plowman Blueprint. It's the standard of the field at the moment. And the book on the Big Five, an excellent book on the Big Five, is Miller's book, Spent. That's a superb document. It's a little crazy
thank you very
at the
much.
End, but that's because Miller's crazy. Yeah. All right. All right, everybody.
All right,
Nathan, back to you.
Thank you very, very much. Just one follow-up question on this. Is it possible that two average parents can give birth to a child that's above average or that's higher
Absolutely.
Than the parents are? Okay.
No question. So an expected range, if you had two parents that are right on the mean at 100 IQ, their child could reasonably be expected to be all the way down to 87 or all the way up to 113. So it wouldn't be surprising at all. That would be a very fairly normal range of variance that would take place. So what we're finding is I can go ahead and upset some people now. Just why not? That's what we do here. This is horse breeding, people. Okay. This is what you're doing. You're breeding horses. All right. And so you can take a couple of fancy people and breed them. You can take a couple of champions, and it turns out that you get a nag. That's just how it is. Or it turns out you get secretariat, or it turns out you get something in the middle. but most of the sons and daughters of secretariat didn't do much. So the whole idea is that once in a while, they get a superstar that generally is not as extraordinary as the parent, but might be very, very good. Okay. But most of the sons and daughters of secretariat are not too special because they've regressed to the mean. And the reason why that's true, just very briefly to clarify why this would work, it's not some magical process. It's that secretariat himself was a particularly bizarre configuration coming out of his own gene pool. So if you could think of a very heterogeneous chocolate shake where there's parts of it that are chocolatier and parts of it are the more vanilla and parts of it didn't get any sugar in it, okay? And you stick your straw in there and you suck it up and it turns out, bam, you hit the really good part. like you might not have, but you just happened to. So that's secretariat. So secretariat is, you know, has a whole slew of genes, and the ones that happen to be the ones that happen to be represented in that particular individual is active. That combination gave rise to a superstar. Now he's a, but he carries with him a whole bunch of other genes, and that when he breeds, those other genes are likely to be the ones that get expressed in the next generation, and they're not as fancy. So he was a particularly a superstar of his own particular gene team. So you can think about then what this is what I call meet the parents. Okay. So you're dating some girl and you think she's pretty hot. And then you kind of, before you get serious, you want to meet the parents. So you meet the parents and you meet the two sisters, and it turns out your girl is the superstar relative to the two sisters. And you're looking at the mom and you're looking at the dad, and you're like, how the heck did you drop out of this group? And now this is going to make you realize, wait a minute, you're an unrepresentative sample of your gene pool. All right. Think about how you feel about it a little bit differently if it turns out that the sisters are just as beautiful and the mom's a goddess and the dad's cool, looks like Cary Grant. It's like, wow, you're an honest representation of your gene pool. See what I'm saying? So this is what the person is that they just happen to be a particular representation of a whole host of genes that they're carrying. And so when you see somebody that's particularly outstanding, good or bad, in other words, far away from the middle of the gene pool, it is extreme. I mean, far away from the general gene pool, the general population, it's exceedingly likely that they are an outlier with respect to their own gene pool. And so that their offspring are going to be reeling it back towards the middle. That's an almost certainty. Okay. So Shaquille O'Neal is clearly the outlier of his gene pool at 7'2". Now his son is 6'11", but that's a pretty big fall. Okay. So he's already come 3 whole inches, which is a lot in terms of, it doesn't seem much to us. Obviously the kid's a giant, but his child will probably be 6'7". Okay, so 2 generations out, Shaquille O'Neal's tallest grandchild is likely to be 6'7". So we see that Shaquille himself was an outlier, and we watch the process of the recirculation of extraordinary genes, and that's why the socioeconomic consequences of this, intermediate or long term, are far more fluid than has been hypothesized previously.
Fascinating. Well, in the PC terms, I guess we are more than just our gene pools, Dr. Lyle, right?
Okay. All right. All right, Nathan.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lyle, as always. We will look forward to hearing from you next week.
Oh, hearing from me. We're going to get Jen Hawk back. She's my favorite.
All right. Yeah, we're looking forward to Dr. Hawk. We got some questions that have been coming in for both of you guys, so we're looking forward to it.
Fabulous.
All right,
folks. We'll see you soon.
Have a good night, Dr. Lyle.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.